This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
Nerds!
Nerds.
Nerds.
Nerds!
What is a nerd?
All right, there's a reason for that. Just hang on, everybody. It's the third most visited website in the U.S. after Google and YouTube, and yet many may have never heard of it. Christine Ligorio-Chafkin is senior writer at Inc., out with a new book, We Are the Nerds, The Birth and Tumultuous Life of Reddit, the Internet's Culture Laboratory, and she joins us in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. We should point out that her husband is our features editor here at Bloomberg Business Week, which I only found out. Did I say, though, your maiden name correctly?
You did, yeah.
Okay, good, because we like to get it right. The book, We Are the Nerds. First of all, you've covered Reddit for a long time. What made you want to finally kind of put it down in a book?
Well, I wanted to put it down in a book far before it was a good enough story to actually become a book. I was fascinated by these two guys, Steve Huffman and Alexis Ohanian, back in 2011 when I first met them. I thought, how did these two really normal-seeming guys create this crazy place on the internet where all the memes are born, all the shiny, wonderful acts of charity happen, and there's all these malicious trolls and pornography and crazy stuff? So I wanted to learn.
I mean, it's amazing, Christine, because anyone who has spent any time around it is both, as you say, sort of fascinated, but also there's some of the most repulsive stuff
that can be
found on the internet that really bubbles up from Reddit.
Right. And I mean, there's also just kind of an air of casual misogyny that abounds. I think some of that has changed recently. But as recent as, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, a business manager of Reddit told a reporter that she would caution all women to stay away from the gaming subreddit, which had 1.5 million subscribers because it was just too sexist.
So who are these guys? I mean, where did they come from?
Right. They came from D.C. suburbs, like totally normal lives in Maryland, and went to University of Virginia. And they were buddies in college who loved playing video games together and decided they wanted to start a startup. You know, sort of the boom and the bust had sort of happened. And then, you know, startups were starting to seem cool again. And Facebook was starting at around the same time. And they went to meet with Paul Graham, who is now famous for founding Y Combinator. Mm-hmm. But Y Combinator was just a sparkle in his eye, a twinkle in his eye at the time. So they met Paul, and Paul said, I don't like your idea for a startup, but why don't you build the front page of the internet? I will give you money for that.
Wow.
Whoa.
Well, that's kind of like blow my mind.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they really have been a key player, though, in digitizing kind of our world, the digital society that we now just take for granted.
Yes, absolutely. Reddit is the home for just everything under the sun on the internet. People post, but they post news stories and links from around the web. Reddit is sort of, I've come to think of it as a mirror of the entire internet, the good and the bad.
Well, tell us about, because it's a pretty big book, healthy book. I'm not sure exactly how many pages here. Almost 500 pages?
500, yeah.
Yeah.
It's 12 years of the company's life. It's a lot.
What were some of the interesting things that you came across in putting this, you know, kind of telling their story?
Absolutely. It is a business book, right? It's the story of this company. And I think the most fascinating stuff, aside from the internet culture aspects, were really just the growth of this unusual business. So it was a little startup at first. Then they sold it to Condé Nast when the company was just more than a year old for, you know, a little more than $10 million. It was sort of nothing. But it made them each millionaires. And 3 years later, they stepped away from the company, leaving just a couple programmers to run this crazy site, which looked like it had more traffic than all of the rest of Condé Nast put together at times. They had very little resources, and yet the community grew and grew and grew. Finally, Condé and Advanced Publications spun it out as its own entity, so then Reddit could act again like a Silicon Valley company and take venture capital, which it did. Mm-hmm. It went through then three leaders and some very, very tumultuous days in the middle years, and yet survived.
And so, Christine, put Reddit into the context of the internet of today and really the social network companies of today. You know, Google and YouTube, obviously, Facebook, Amazon, Twitter, all of them very much in the headlines these days. not always for good reasons.
Sure.
How does Reddit fit into that sort of landscape?
Well, it's right squashed in the middle of all of those things. Some people joke that it's like an anti-social network because users are anonymous on it, or at least most are. So it's slightly different in that regard. I look at Reddit as almost the opposite of the airbrushed internet, you know, the Instagram and Pinterest, which are full of influencers and overly photoshopped. Reddit is, you know, average Joes posting stuff that they don't want their bosses to read. It's like, give me financial advice. Give me legal advice. Tell me, should I break up with my girlfriend? You know, it's like this regular Joe online, plus, you know, a little bit of everything else that you see. So I think that's why it is just vastly popular. It's the internet's virality engine. It's sort of where memes and the thoughts of the day become popular. When something bubbles up to the top of the homepage of Reddit, it's definitely ready for mainstream news.
I love that you say it's kind of the antithesis of the picture-perfect Instagram world. It's like, you know, you get home, you change, you open up a beer, eat some cold pizza. I don't know.
Right. And then you might want to just look at a meme or hear a funny joke or hear a, you know, today I effed up kind of story.
Anyway.
Christine, Carol just gave you a very specific description. This is making me sort of question Carol's after work habits. But
no,
we'll leave it there.
It's not me.
Christine Ligorio-Chafkin. The book is We Are the Nerds, The Birth and Tumultuous Life of Reddit, the Internet's Culture Laboratory. There better be a copy of that on my desk when I get back, Carol.
All right, we'll make sure there is.
You don't get it, shame on you. Funny, funny, funny what money can do them that have it.
Our next guest works with the ultra-high net worth individuals. We're talking about families, trust, foundations. I want to get into some of the trends that he's seeing, the kind of conversations he's having with his clients when they want to put money to work. Michael Tiedemann is CEO and CIO of Tiedemann Advisors in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio on this Tuesday. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm always curious about, so you're working with high net worth individuals and they want to preserve their money. They don't want to lose it.
That's right.
They also want to make some money off of it too. And I know that they've been increasingly, Jason and I have a lot of conversations, how they're increasingly moving into the types of investments that private equity investors do, whether it's investing in a company outright and so on. What are the kind of conversations you're having with some of these high net worth individuals about what they're interested, what they want to know about, where they want to maybe park some money?
Well, with respect to private equity, this is we say it's both secular and cyclical. So the cyclical part of it is that people see the trailing returns of the space in general, but then obviously unbelievable successes that people selectively focus on of direct deals. So this does happen. It happens usually later in the cycle, and a lot of the high net worth investors bring deals to us. And our view is those deals are sourced generally in a secondary, third market, i.e. they've been looked at by the leaders in the space and passed on. So the first thing we ask them is, why do you think you're seeing this opportunity? Second thing is, it's a full-time job scrubbing those deals, finding the competitive landscape, pricing it, and actually structuring the deal as well to protect themselves. And that's something that is most individuals can't do. Where it does or can make sense is when someone comes from an industry, they created their wealth in a specific industry and they're domain experts there and they really understand
the
nuances and the networks and what have you, can, you know, back channel check a deal and how relevant that can be.
Michael, I also wanted to ask you about kind of a generational shift that seems to be happening. We're looking at, by what I think is by many measures, the largest transfer of wealth that we've ever seen from the current sort of older generation to the next sort of millennial style, for lack of a better term, wealthy folks in terms of inheriting wealth, but also a lot of new entrepreneurial wealth being created. What do you see in terms of the different appetite for this younger, wealthier set in terms of how and where they're investing their money?
Great question. That's why we have a trust company, for starters, but also why we brought on one of the leading teams in impact investing. So within that space, and really generationally, you're beginning to see the next generation, their starting point is so robust in terms of the wealth that they have, that the conversation is really based more about where they want to invest, the types of businesses. So within public markets, not just negative screening, which is what most people think of when, you know, socially responsible investing,
right, No tobacco, no guns, exactly. That sort of thing, right?
Yeah. But the next level is positive screening and really focusing on businesses that are behaving and making decisions and quality decisions. Ironically, it's not that far off what the broad space of quality active managements are focused on. There's a lot more in common than people think, but nevertheless, positive screening. And then the third really is within the private space and actual impact investing, where you are affordable housing could be an example of that, where you will take a lower IRR, but you know that a city or a place that you care about, you're not giving the money away, you're investing it, you're just accepting a lower return and also doing good. And so that...
Do you see a lot of that happening?
Yes.
Really?
It's one of the largest growing spaces without quite...
Not ESG overall, but something that is as specific as that, where you're saying, you know what, I live in this community or I live near this community, I want to make it better, so I may accept a lower rate of return, but it's a good thing, it's the right thing to do.
Yes, and so the starting place a few years ago was de minimis, really. It was families doing it, taking care of the community.
Right.
It's now becoming more and more formalized, so you're seeing people locally, place-based investing, as well as organizations that are actually have, you know, an organizational skill set to run a business, as well as invest the capital effectively and manage those processes. And so that is a fast-growing and, we think, very relevant part of portfolios, and, you know, certainly multi-generational portfolios.
Michael, you worked for a time for Credit Suisse and oversaw sales and trading for Latin America there. So you have insights into how different geographies may affect family offices and ultra high net worth. What do you see in terms of those differences? Are the risk appetites different, or where they put their money different? What do you see?
Are you referring to non-U.S. families?
Yes, exactly, non-U.S. families.
Well, when you look at, and I'll use Brazil as an example, historically, a lot of Brazilian families had capital offshore, largely due to the fact that over long periods of time, they had hyperinflation, they had, you know, an unstable tax regime or political regime. And so they were taking their money and placing it offshore. And also, there are a lot of tax schemes. A lot of that got legitimized in the last few years. And those families now are running their portfolio, and they're really trying to create a balance to how they're invested, the currencies in which they're invested, the type of underlying assets in which they're invested. So the starting place is very different than an American investor saying, I want to invest in inexpensive, high growing, faster growing emerging market assets. And that's, you know, that when we think about it, we're investing in dollars. The first thing you're doing is buying the currency.
Right.
And then obviously, and that's been the largest problem this year, but that's ultimately, most people don't know how to underwrite the currency, but they know how to underwrite the growth and you know, the consumer growth, et cetera, that they see in those markets.
We're going to leave it on that note. Michael, thank you so much. Nice to get some time with you.
Thanks again.
Yeah, Michael Tiedemann. He is Chief Executive Officer, Chief Investment Officer at Tiedemann Wealth Management, joining us in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser here in New York. Jason Kelly out there in our London bureau. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week, and this is Bloomberg Radio.